The next case is Octavia Jones versus the Commissioner of Internal Revenue.
May it please the Court, good morning. My name is Teresa McLaughlin, and I represent the Commissioner. The Commissioner's position is that the tax court erred in striking down the Treasury regulation that established the 2-year deadline for seeking equitable innocent spouse relief. And this is a question that has split the tax court, but the two courts of appeals that have reached the issue have decided that, agreed with the Commissioner, that the regulation is valid. And we know that you're not bound by those decisions.
73rd.
Yes, but we commend them to you. And unless the court has another preference, I'd like to discuss the first step of Chevron first. And that is whether there's room in Section 6015, room for interpretation for the Commissioner to set this deadline. And our position is that the tax court dissenters and the Third and Seventh Circuits were correct that the statute doesn't really speak the precise question presented. It is true that the statute contains express 2-year deadlines for the two forms of relief that are an entitlement if the prerequisites are established. But the provision we have here is different in character. And its express language allows the Commissioner to prescribe procedures by which he can dispense equitable relief if the taxpayer is not eligible for the entitlement forms of relief. So although the taxpayer relies on the general presumption that when Congress provides something in one place but doesn't do it in another, that means that it didn't intend to provide one. Well, we think it's more complicated than that because Congress has a practice of sometimes leaving a statute of limitations up to a court or an agency to fill in. And we think it is interstitial. And we think that there is a textual basis for allowing the Commissioner to write regulations establishing a deadline, and that is the language expressly authorizing, in subsection F itself, expressly authorizing the Commissioner to prescribe procedures for dispensing equitable relief. And also, there is a broad grant of regulation writing authority in subsection H of the statute. So we think that this sort of deadline is precisely the thing that Congress may have had in mind, and that there really is not, I think the tax court called it an audible silence. We don't think that there's at least ambiguity there, and there's room for interpretation.
Audible silence is very poetic, but it's sort of incomprehensible.
Well, it's tough to understand. It's like, I guess it's a contradiction in terms.
It looks as if F is an especially equitable provision that was given to the custody of the Commissioner and to regulate. And the Commissioner could have provided a much more relaxed claim provisions for a claimant invoking that act, but it also could have, your argument, we could have taking the 2-year parallel to see. But it seems to me Congress also allowed the Commissioner to put in 5 years or put in some kind of equitable latches at courts determined. Or your argument is that Congress basically created a wild card that permitted that Commissioner to regulate.
Yes, exactly, Your Honor. So on
the difficulty from my perspective would be if you were say that your interpretation is not even permissible, that it's just so far off the reservation that it's not even permissible. we would have to hold that the statutory limitations period is not a procedure. And that's a kind of a hard road linguistically to pursue, to say that language under procedures, that the statute of limitations is somehow not a procedure, and especially when in the same statute, I know headings are not dispositive of anything, but in the same statute, which is subsection B, it says procedures for relief from liability applicable to all joint filers, and then large E speaks of a statute of limitations. In other words, Congress has spoke of a statute of limitations as a procedure.
Exactly.
In this very statute, they've spoken of it as a procedure. And then we would have to say that the language in subsection under procedures prescribed by the commissioner, that it's not a procedure in a statute where they said it's a procedure.
Exactly, Your Honor, and I don't think Congress meant to put the courts in that kind of position. So,
if the Supreme Court's been very protective of the authority of agencies under Chevron 2, then you've got that additional support in subsection 8,
yes, sir,
which is permissive.
Exactly.
And you've got the language may in subsection F, whereas in either B or C, there's the use of the word shall.
Right, Your Honor.
In the face of all that, kind of difficult to say. You haven't even crafted a permissible view. You haven't even taken a permissible view of the statute. I don't understand how we can do that. We'd be creating a circuit split in the area of tax. The
Supreme Court would pick that.
Well, I think we understand your case.
All right. Well, unless the court had any questions on Chevron Step 2, you know, our position is that this is the closest thing to what Congress may have intended to choose 2 years. The Supreme Court in Mayo recently.
When it gets to the number of years, you don't have to guess that. It seems to me if Congress left that open, and you, the commissioner could, the agency could say that equitable relief is of a different type and you want to apply for the 3 years. But
yes,
we don't second guess that if it's permissible.
Right.
Now, the argument that we have to hear from the other side. It wasn't permissible.
Right. And even where a statute calls for individualized determinations, a regulation that provides a bright line rule is acceptable. And the Supreme Court just said so in January in the Mayo case, which was a tax case. So unless the court has any questions, I will save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
We have
no questions. All right. Thank you very much.
But why would we go and just gratuitously create a circuit split with two other circuits in an area in which the value of uniformity is prized? We don't normally want the IRS operating under one set of rules in one jurisdiction, one set of rules in another jurisdiction. So where you have two circuits, why would we be creating a split like this, which just creates all sorts of administrative problems?
Your Honor, I think the first issue that I see, first of all, to address the Seventh Circuit thing, because I think that's what the panel is focused on, which is their argument. But we have a situation where Congress considered 2 year deadlines. They placed a 2 year deadline in subsection B. They put a 2-year deadline in subsection C, and in the context of equitable relief in F, Congress did not repeat that deadline. And there's an uncodified provision as part of the same act, which is section 3201G2. And it speaks of 2-year periods and the deadlines. And what that does, and it's in page 72 of the addendum, this is where Congress is considering the deadlines that it has under 6015. And it doesn't mention any deadline for F. And the focus that the IRS has taken, which the panel had taken in respect of the opening arguments, is the word procedures. That terminology appears... That terminology appears as the introductory language to F. It also appears as the introductory language to B, and B then sets out a series of requirements, which we believe are substantive requirements, including B1E, which is the 2-year deadline. And the headings on both B and C are procedures.
How do you get to the point that a statute of limitations is not...
In this case, first of all, the IRS has said, the commissioner has stated, that this is an absolute deadline. It is an absolute cutoff. There are no exceptions. He has said equitable tolling does not apply, and it's essentially a statute of repose. And I think by citing the Begerle case in the equitable tolling statute...
Oh, the totality of the circumstances still obtains. It's just that that's resolved on that the totality of the circumstances is reserved for the merits.
Disagree, Your Honor.
It doesn't rule out the totality of the circumstances test. It's just that the totality of the circumstances
completely
is resolved in determining whether the relief should be awarded on the merit.
But, Your Honor, it completely cuts off at the head the situation to even get to the court. And I think the argument that the commissioner is making is that this provision is committed solely to agency discretion. Indeed, Judge Posner in the Seventh Circuit opinion stated that you could have the equities on your side and you could meet the deadline and the commissioner could still disallow relief. But in 2006, in the 2006 Act, the Tax Relief and Health Care Act, Congress stepped in and amended the statute to provide the tax court with jurisdiction to review the commissioner's determinations under F. That provision is not committed solely to his discretion.
Well, but it says under procedures prescribed by the secretary.
If I can address the procedure.
Let me ask you another question here. Did you say, well, this 2-year statute of limitations is so strict, but the 2-year statute of limitations doesn't run from the filing of the return. The 2-year statute of limitations runs from the time of the initial collection effort, as I understand it.
It's the 2-year period will run off the first collection action activity, which the commissioner defines as the first notice that goes out. Whether it's received or not, the commissioner...
Well, but I mean, it doesn't run from the filing of the return. It runs when the commissioner begins collection activity.
But wouldn't that make that particular statute of limitations a statute of repose, effectively a substantive provision? I think that's what the Webb case...
No, it's the 2-year limitations period from the time. Who knows? Is the collection activity sending a notice, or is the collection activity involve a levy upon a bank account or some attachment of an account? Not clear to me. That's another question. It's not involved today. But what I'm saying is, it would be a lot harsher situation if the 2-year limitations period ran from the filing of the return, rather than the point of collection activity.
I agree with it, Your Honor.
You know, there's a lot of good reasons why the Secretary can make the argument, but there, F is an equitable provision that isn't even limited to the size. It's limited to any person or any equitable circumstance, not just to the challenge to the assessment, but also to the non-payment. And it's really a wild card. And the department decided that we're going and regulating that wildfire, we're going to parallel B and C, but Congress didn't want to mandate that necessarily. It left it up to the Secretary because it did mandate the entitlements to the spouse in B and C.
And those are statutory entitlements. And I think...
Well, they are. And those are Congress.
But and if you meet the specific requirements, you get relief.
It says it is inequitable. You can give relief if it is inequitable to hold the individual liable for any unpaid tax or any deficiency. Now, we're talking about individual is may not even be a spouse. It could be a lot of things, couldn't it?
Well, I think that's limited to a set of circumstances where it is an innocent spouse.
It could.
But,
maybe.
And indeed, and we're not contesting this, revenue procedure.
It's not limited by its terms.
Well, I think that's how Congress crafted it. I think that provision was designed as an equitable remedy. And I don't think we can escape the equity. I mean, equity in that provision.
Equities, it is an equitable remedy. And as Judge Posner observed, equity maybe calls for latches. But,
Well, the commissioner says that there are no exceptions. This is an absolute.
Oh, I know.
If you went to equitable polling, and even Manila went there.
That goes to whether what the commissioner did is permissible.
Yeah.
The first step in the Chevron is whether there is a blank left open for
deadlines in there.
Yeah, right.
And our position is...
And the tax court took the position that the commissioner didn't, the secretary didn't have that part. I think there are a lot of explanations why Congress would structure it this way to leave that open for agency development. If once you get by Chevron 1, you're really arguing Chevron 2, whether it's permissible or reasonable.
Well, I think that's in some respects correct as well, but I think it goes also into 1 because I don't think you can ignore the fact that it is an equitable provision. And step 1 is not focused simply on silence. It's focused on congressional intent and employing the statutory tools.
What if the Secretary put in a provision instead of 2 years? I understand your intention of 2 years harsh. But instead of putting in 2 years, the Secretary said, file such claim in a context where the claimant does not sit on his or her rights and permit the courts to establish by an act. They said that explicitly. Could they have done that?
I think they could have, and indeed, the tax court, in the Lance opinion, stated that timing is a factor. It could be considered as a factor.
Could Congress have committed, if the Secretary put that in with this provision, 6015F, did the Secretary have authority to defer to the courts and say, this is a question of elections? Should be applied in this equitable provision, and we'll let the courts apply the common law doctrine of latches. Would that work?
I think that would work. I think the court can consider the factor.
Now, I think that's a reasonable answer, but if you say that, you're jumping a Chevron 1. And we're really, the argument really comes down to Chevron Step 2, which is the selection of 2 years as opposed to latches a permissible?
If I could answer that question. The Seventh Circuit got to latches because it saw the word equity. But But they had to consider it and dropped it on the undermining argument that the limitations would be undermined. But circling back, I think it's not a question of getting to step two in my mind. It's the fact that the commissioner must consider all the facts and circumstances under F in reaching a determination that's then reviewable by the tax court. And if the commissioner, and there's a legislative history which we've cited from the 1984 Act.
That doesn't quite address my question. My question was, your position is that the statute is clear. Congress has spoken, and the secretary, therefore, is not free. An act of regulation imposing a time.
Our position is that.
At least that's the tax court. They said audible.
I think that the tax court's position is the commissioner could not adopt the same exact 2-year deadline that was in B and C. Congress could not have intended it. We don't have that before us, but, you know, conceivably, you know, if the commissioner had promulgated that, if the commissioner had promulgated that particular statute, it would have to run through the same Chevron analysis, and it may, in fact, be reasonable. But I think, again, fixing a statute without any exception.
I mean, I'm asking you, if the commissioner said there's a five-year statute of limitations, would you be okay with that?
No. If it's a fixed five-year statute, it's, there still would be issues.
Going to whether it's permissible. And that's a, I think we can address this argument, but you sort of are skipping over what I think is the key to the tax court's holding. They basically said the secretary couldn't act in this area because Congress has spoken clearly and unambiguous.
I think the tax
by
court...
By audible silence. Is that your position?
At the end, that is not my position. Our position is based on tax court's position in Land, which says that timing can be considered as one of the facts and circumstances. And on this particular date, we're not going to decide the issue of a longer deadline because, in effect, the court didn't have that before. My position would be that if they did a three-year or a five-year,
if it's fixed, you're basically arguing the number two is the wrong thing, or the number five is the wrong thing, that it ought to be some kind of a sliding or softer deadline. But you're not addressing whether the secretary had authority to act at all. If the secretary has authority to act, then the second question is what the secretary picked.
And whether that's reasonable interpretation.
Yeah, right. And that is an argument you seem to be making, and that's fair enough. But then we get past the first and we really just have an argument now whether we agree with the commission or whether what the commission secretary did was reasonable. And I think you have a hard road to hoe there.
Part of the difficulty here from your standpoint is that this provision is loaded with discretionary language. It's just loaded. And it says, it begins by saying, under procedures prescribed by the secretary. That's the first grant of discretionary language. Then it says the secretary may relieve such individuals, such liability. Then it gives the secretary in Section H the authority to prescribe such regulations as are necessary to carry out the provisions of this section. It was open for Congress to have chosen a longer period or a longer limitations period than it did. But what it did was it loaded up this provision with a lot of language which seems to sort of repose responsibility within the secretary. And then you're saying you want us to say that a permissive grant of authority to the secretary resulted in an impermissible view by the secretary in the very area in which the permissive grant was made. It just doesn't compute.
Well, if I can address the discretion issue in the word may and the various items. Commissioner says this is sweeping discretion. Disagree with that because, again, the 2006 Act didn't give the commissioner absolute discretion under this piece. It pulled back. Congress stepped in and said, no, the tax court has the authority to review these decisions, review what the determination the commissioner's making. In addition, the Neal case, which is an 11th Circuit case, indicated that the scope of review is de novo in both the tax court and 11th Circuit. The Porter case, which is also a tax court case, appealable to this circuit, wasn't appealed, decided that both the scope and the standard of review under F are de novo. I can't square de novo with the kind of sweeping discretion that the commissioner is stating. Now, to put in a procedure, I would say under this provision, the way in the lead up to 1998 is that The Congress intended the commissioner to adopt procedures, including the form, so that spouses could go to the commissioner and get relief on an immediate basis. And I wouldn't read F to say that the commissioner can erect the same two-year deadline that Congress considered under B and C and put the onus on the innocent spouse to meet that two-year deadline in circumstances that might include abuse and deception, and that would run to step two of Chevron. If I can address that, which I think Judge Niemeyer is steering me to.
You're arguing basically that it wasn't reasonable to take a two-year term when B and C had 2 years, and this was intended to be additional equitable relief. That's your argument.
Well, we think, and just to say it clearly, we think this fails under Chevron step one. And the reason for that is the Rosello case and the statutory tools of construction, which would be you got a two-year deadline, and you got no deadline stated by Congress. And if you apply that in the General Motors case, which we cite in the brief, there's another Supreme Court case that dealt with statute of limitations and applied that same principle. We think that's what Chevron says. But getting to step two, I don't see how this can be considered to be a reasonable interpretation. We have those same two-year limitations in B and C, and this provision is structured in the context of equity. And what the commissioner says is there are no exceptions at all. It's an absolute provision. And I think, you know, if I can just read from the Holmberg versus Armbrecht case, which says, traditionally and for good reasons, statute limitations are not controlling measures of equitable relief. Equity eschews mechanical rules. It depends on flexibility. And so in the context of an equitable remedy, and considering what Congress was trying to accomplish.
If you understand in its totality what you're actually asking us to do, you're asking us to take very permissive on the procedures prescribed by the Secretary of State and hold that under this very permissive language, the Secretary's interpretation would be removed. You're asking us to create a circuit split, two other circuits, which would just go in the area of tax administration, which Congress has charged the Secretary with a certain degree of discretion. We're supposed to take this permissive language, hold that the Secretary's view is impermissible, and in the same breath, create a circuit split with two other circuits in an area in which all the circuit courts have argued that uniformity and administrability is a desirable consideration. Now, on about three counts, you're asking us to do a lot, and in a sense, to put our heads in the mouth of the cannon, because it'll go up and will be reversed.
If I can address that point.
Well, it's nice if you want us to sort of charge into the breach.
I understand that holding in favor of the taxpayer here, other than on the alternative grounds which we raised under 9100 and equitable polling, would create a split. But I don't think I can't underestimate or say the importance of this case for spouses like Octavia Jones and other spouses. There's a case that was in the tax court in January where it's a Stevenson case where the husband had a gun to the spouse or the wife's head during this two-year period and said, if you leave me, I will kill you. Tax court considered that. The commissioner came in and applied his two-year rule and said no relief. Those are the sets of circumstances that I think all these taxpayers are out of court. They're out of luck, and the commissioner is not going to provide any relief.
That's a fine argument for a legislative hearing. It's a policy argument, and it may be very well taken. But it's Congress's job to set these policies, and it's within Congress's prerogative to say that the Secretary can make choices.
But to address that point, we did provide on April 20th, there were letters sent by a large number of congressmen in respect to this issue was sent directly to the commission. And it says that what the commissioner, by adopting this two-year rule, and those letters were spurned by the Stevenson case that I just mentioned.
You know that letters sent by congressmen to the commissioner is not a proper basis for action.
But this is not just post hoc legislative history. This is the commissioner, this is the Congress members, including very high-ranking members, 49 congressmen. And the commissioner cites the Tualatin case where congressional letter was considered. It's in this exact same circumstance.
Sir, we can't make a decision based on the rank of the congressman who forms an agency and letter.
But the Ninth Circuit case that the commissioner cites in his brief, the Tualatin case, actually does rely on a congressional letter for purposes of discerning congressional intent.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Buckman, can you clear up one question for me? Did the Secretary ever state reasons for adopting the two-year rule?
There is a preface to the proposed and final regulation, I believe, in the comments. It was put out for notice and comment. I don't think anybody brought up the deadline. And
is this a problem, is what I'm getting at?
No, I don't think it is a problem. It's true when you have adjudicative rulemaking, as in the Chenery case, in the Fox Television case, of course, the agency has to give its reasons for adopting the rule that it does. But when the agency is coming out of the blocks with a notice and comment rule, it doesn't have to do that. And I think the Supreme Court made it clear in the Verizon Communications case that an agency must explain the basis for a change in its policy, but that review of its initial determination isn't any more searching. And I discovered yesterday that our citation of the Verizon case was garbled, and it's actually in 535 U.S., page 467. And the comment that we relied on was at page 503, note 20. And finally, about the congressional correspondence, one thing the congressman, the letter signed by the 49 House members, asked the commissioner to do was to undertake a review of his policy. And last week, Congressman McDermott released a letter, a reply from the commissioner saying, I am undertaking, you know, we are undertaking a review of the policy behind this two-year rule. And if at the conclusion of that review, the commissioner takes a position that would affect his position in this case, we will, of course, let you know.
Just let her know and give her some relief. Maybe she deserves a little bit, doesn't she?
Well, unless the court had any more questions, we'll rest on our brief. Thank you.
We'll come down and recounsel and move directly into our next case. Thank you.